From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been nearly a year since voters in South Africa elected Nelson Mandela president. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with South African journalist Alistair Sparks about how his country is dealing with the human rights violations of the apartheid era. Also today, we hear from Canadian writer Evelyn Lau. At 14, she ran away from home and made her living on the street as a prostitute. Her 1989 memoir, Runaway, Diary of a Street Kid, became a bestseller in Canada. Her latest, Fresh Girls, has just been released in the United States. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the latest from Michael Chabon. His master's thesis in college became the 1988 bestseller, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has unveiled the next part of Vice President Gore's Reinventing Government plan. Mr. Clinton says this will generate more than $13 billion in savings over 5 years. He wants to use this to finance a middle-class tax break, UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
President Clinton held up a check from the FCC for $7.7 billion, money raised by auctioning radio frequencies.
When I say we want government that works like the best private business, the first rule is taxpayers don't want the government to give any of their property away for free when it ought to be paid for.
Before last year, that's exactly what the government would do. The president also announced plans to cut, consolidate, or sell parts of four agencies: NASA, the Small Business Administration, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Interior Department. NASA stands to get hit the hardest, losing $5 billion of a $14 billion budget. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
The National Labor Relations Board has asked a federal court to grant an injunction against baseball owners. This would force them to restore parts of the sport's expired collective bargaining agreement. The papers have been filed in U.S. District Court in New York. Both sides in the baseball strike are supposed to negotiate again this evening. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a suit against state officials in Michigan because the state is not in compliance with a federal motor voter law. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The motor voter law allows people to register to vote at the same place where they register their automobiles. It also allows for voter registration at libraries and public assistance offices. The law took effect the first of the year, but Michigan, which already offered registration at motor vehicle offices, has not expanded the service into the other required areas. The ACLU hopes to rectify that. The lawsuit filed in federal court on behalf of two community organizations says the state has ignored the law, but Michigan's Republican Governor John Engler says the federal government needs to come up with the money needed to implement the law. Without that, Engler says, this is an unfunded mandate. Michigan is one of five states not in compliance with the motor voter law. The others are California, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The United States has warned Turkey about keeping its troops in northern Iraq for an extended time. It's also expressed concern about reported attacks on civilians. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has directed the U.S. ambassador in Turkey to raise these concerns with Turkish Prime Minister Tansu Çiller. The Clinton administration had been sympathetic at first to the Turkish attacks on Kurd rebel fighters in northern Iraq, but there are new reports about the Turkish attacks on civilians, and the Clinton administration fears the campaign might not end quickly. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 12.5 points at 4,151. The Nasdaq is up 3 points at 821. This is NPR. Federal Reserve Board member John Lewere is resigning. This will give President Clinton a chance to name a third central bank governor. Lewere, a former bank executive, submitted his resignation to the president today. His resignation comes on the eve of tomorrow's meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee. This sets monetary policy for the Fed. Lewere's resignation also comes at a time when many economists believe the Fed is nearing the end of a string of increases in interest rates. The increases were intended to slow the economy and stifle inflation. The 67th Academy Awards presentation will take place tonight at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles. NPR's Ina Jaffe has this preview.
Forrest Gump dominated the Oscar nominations with 13, and it's expected to take most of the major categories, including Best Film. Tom Hanks starred in the story of a young man from the South who somehow comes through the traumas of life and history unscathed, despite having an IQ of 75. Hanks is nominated for Best Actor. He won that award last year for his work in the film Philadelphia. If he wins again tonight, he'd be the first actor to win in consecutive years since Spencer Tracy, almost 50 years ago. Hanks has strong competition, however, from John Travolta, who starred in Pulp Fiction, and from Paul Newman, nominated for his work in Nobody's Fool. For Best Actress, Gossip and Oddsmakers favor Jodie Foster for her role in Nell and Jessica Lange for Blue Sky. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
A published report says new drugs to fight obesity could have an easier time getting government approval. The Food and Drug Administration is considering rules that would speed the approval process for such drugs. The Wall Street Journal reports the agency will probably cut the human testing requirement for the drugs from 2 years to one. That's the recommendation of an FDA advisory panel, which also says there's no need to require proof that the drugs lower the risk of obesity-related diseases. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alistair Sparks, is one of South Africa's leading journalists. He's the former editor of the anti-apartheid newspaper, the Rand Daily Mail, and he chronicled the injustices of apartheid in his 1989 book, The Mind of South Africa. Last year, Sparks uncovered the story of the secret negotiations that led to power sharing in South Africa. Sparks discussed these secret meetings with us last year. They're the subject of his new book, Tomorrow is Another Country, the inside story of South Africa's road to change. Now that South Africa has entered a new era of democracy, it's deciding how to deal with the human rights violations of the past. The government is creating a commission for truth and reconciliation to seek, quote, understanding but not vengeance. The commission is expected to have subpoena power to question officials about abuses during the apartheid era. The officials will be given immunity from prosecution, indemnity, but only if they admit to what they did. Sparks says that members of both the African National Congress and the government required indemnity in order for power sharing to go forward.
Well, there have been indemnities given for all of the ANC exile leaders for a start. Those who came back, who had headed the guerrilla army, were not charged with crimes of sedition, terrorism, revolutionary coup attempts, and so on. Likewise, on the government side, a number of police officers have been given indemnity, people who had been involved in assassinations and crimes of that sort. But the government is saying that even though they have already been granted indemnity, and that was done under the old regime, the truth must out. We must know what happened. We have to know, for example, who killed Steve Biko. More than 100 detainees died in detention cells. There's a great need felt in the black community to know who did that and why, what were the circumstances. There were other high-profile people who were killed in exile, who were killed in South Africa, or against whom various dirty tricks activities were carried out. So there is tremendous pressure to bring out the truth of those events, even if people are not prosecuted as a result.
So what will the process be for trying to arrive at the truth?
The law is not yet enacted. There is a bill before Parliament. It's being heatedly debated because, of course, members of the old regime who form part of the new government of national reconciliation are strongly opposed to that. So there isn't agreement yet. There's still a bargaining process taking place. My guess is that we will have a law setting up such a commission, and anybody who wishes to claim indemnity on the grounds that crimes committed for political motives can be indemnified will be able to do so on application to the commission. If such an individual doesn't make that kind of application, then, of course, he or she would still be liable to prosecution under the ordinary criminal law.
So, in other words, if you confess to the truth, you won't get punished for it, but if you're discovered and you haven't admitted what happened, you will be punished.
That's the general idea yet, but as I say, it's...
It's not official yet.
It's not official yet, but I believe that that is what will come within a matter of a month or two.
Now, this is very controversial in South Africa. Are there people who feel strongly that those who participated in crimes and human rights violations in the past should be punished whether they confess to those crimes or not.
Well, yes, particularly, of course, the relatives of victims of such activities. But there is another level to all of this too, Terry, that is very controversial indeed. You see, the people who carried out these acts are saying, we did it under orders. This, of course, was the old defense that was presented at Nuremberg by the Nazis. They said, you know, Befehl ist Befehl, orders are orders. We were ordered to do this. We were simply loyal servants of the government, and we carried out our instructions in a true patriotic fashion. Now, we know that Nuremberg struck that down and said that if you got an unjust order, you had to defy it. But it does open up the whole murky territory of who gave these instructions. And that immediately starts pointing fingers at the leadership of the old regime, the leaders of the National Party, who, of course, are now part of the new government of national unity and reconciliation. Fingers pointed even at people like ex-president de Klerk.
Well, I imagine it will be very uncomfortable for those people who are still in positions of authority now, if misdeeds of the past are revealed.
Well, yes, the essence of the argument is that people such as de Klerk say, you cannot have reconciliation if you rake up the wounds of the past. The ANC, on the other hand, says you cannot have reconciliation unless you have confession and forgiveness.
So the Truth Commission is a kind of middle ground in a way.
That's right. It's going to be controversial either way, and it's not going to be easily resolved.
What do you most want to know about the past?
Well, friends of mine were killed, in particular a man named Matthew Goniwe. I had a very high regard for him, and he was a friend of mine. He was very brutally assassinated, his body sliced into pieces, he was burnt. It is said that parts of his anatomy were cut off and kept in formaldehyde, and that the security police used these to terrify the people they were interrogating. I would like to know the truth of what happened to my friend, and I believe that that goes for a great many South Africans, particularly black South Africans, who suffered a number of grievous atrocities of this nature. I think it is also important to know who killed Steve Biko in 1977, another high-profile case. But I think, given a few of those, of the cases that have been controversial, that have been in the news now for years, I think most people on the ANC side would feel satisfied.
My guest is South African journalist Alistair Sparks. He has a new book called Tomorrow is Another Country, the inside story of South Africa's road to change. And it's about the years of secret agreements between the white South African government and Nelson Mandela while Mandela was still in prison, agreements that led to the beginning of democracy in South Africa. One of the big unresolved questions that pertain to the end of the white rule regime was whether there was a so-called third force, whether the South African police and the Inkatha movement were in cahoots with each other in organizing violence and massacres against black South Africans in townships. Has there been any new information about whether there was this kind of collusion or not?
Yes, indeed, Terry. I go into this in some depth in my book, bring out a lot of the evidence pointing to such collusion, and not on the part of the police force as a whole, but certainly elements within the police, elements within the military, particularly the military intelligence unit, were in cahoots with elements of the Inkatha Freedom Party, which had it had its own police force, which was turning a blind eye to these activities. But it also had people who were secretly trained by these rogue security officers. And there is a great deal of evidence. I mention it in the book. Evidence has been uncovered not only of the smuggling of weapons to these people, but even of a crude weapons factory that was established in one of the cities near Johannesburg, and of how leading members of the Inkatha Freedom Party were used as couriers to carry these weapons out into the rural areas where the so-called black-on-black violence was taking place. And indeed, there is a trial underway at the moment, a trial of the key police officer who was involved in this kind of activity. That trial has been underway for several months. I think it will continue for some time. The officer concerned is facing more than 100 charges of murder and attempts to murder.
You write in your book about a police attack in which several blacks were killed by the police. This was in Boipatang. Am I saying that right?
Boipatong, yes. It's a township near Johannesburg where a great deal of this violence occurred. There had been a massacre there in which raiders from a nearby hostel containing members of the Inkatha Freedom Party, quite clearly part of this general conspiracy, had carried out a raid on a township, swooping through the township, hacking people to death and shooting them in their beds. I went out shortly after that, interviewing people in the township. President de Klerk, as he was then, had paid a visit, but he had been chased out by the angry crowd who were convinced that he was involved in this, or certainly that his police were involved. After he'd gone and the township was in a state of great ferment, it suddenly transpired that a black guy had been killed. He was lying there in an open field, and the police gathered around him. The crowd was accusing the police of having killed him. The police, in turn, were refusing to allow the crowd to retrieve the body and take it away for their own funeral process. And there was a standoff, face-to-face, and I got caught in the middle of this. The crowd was very excited, very worked up. The police themselves were also very tense. It was an ugly moment. And then in the middle of this, a gunshot went off, and that, without any order to fire being given, led the line of police officers to believe that an order had indeed been given. So they opened fire at point-blank range, literally just 1 or 2 yards away. They just blasted into this crowd with heavy-gauge shotguns. And about 3 people were killed and some 30 or 40 were injured. But, you know, a great deal of this kind of thing went on. That was just one that I happened to witness firsthand. And so as a journalist, I was able to write about it as an eyewitness reporter, which made it, of course, a graphic story. But it was by no means the worst massacre. These things were taking place all over South Africa at that time. In all, 3,000 people were killed in clashes with the police over a 5-year period, and 33,000 were detained without trial under the states of emergency.
Now, do you think that the Truth Commission, when it is established, would investigate an incident like this one?
No, I think this would rate as a lesser incident. I think they would look at the high-profile assassinations that took place. My guess is that they would not go for this kind of thing.
Is there still police violence in South Africa now?
I think there is still a certain amount of police violence. But I think what is more serious is the ineffectiveness of the police in controlling crime, in controlling disruptive activities that continue to take place around the country. I think the police are a deeply alienated force. And they felt themselves to be engaged in a kind of holy war against the African National Congress. They were saving their country from a deadly enemy that they believe was being directed and manipulated from Moscow. And they were fighting for the fatherland. The next thing, their president turned around and said, we got to do a deal with these people. And I think for these, I have a measure of sympathy for the police. They had been worked up into a state of great aggression and great patriotic fervor over this war, and then suddenly they were told it was over, and they had to turn around and start protecting the people they'd been told were the deadly enemies of the country. And I think they found this very difficult to understand and even more difficult to accept. And for them now to be serving that government, which only yesterday was the enemy, I think has created a credibility gap between government and security forces that is the single most dangerous thing in the new South Africa. President Mandela doesn't have a police force of his own that he can supplant the old one with. What he has tried to do is to remove the top officer corps, but he's even had to be careful about that, because he has to retain people who themselves, commanders that is, who themselves have credibility with rank and file in the police force. And the same goes for the military. And to that extent, he's been stuck with some of the old guard commanding officers, but he is now slowly trying to bring in people that he trusts rather better than the old guard.
My guest is South African journalist Alistair Sparks. He's the author of the new book, Tomorrow is Another Country. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. South African journalist Alistair Sparks is my guest. His new book is called Tomorrow is Another Country, The Inside Story of South Africa's Road to Change. Do you have a sense that day-to-day life is very different now, different since Nelson Mandela became president?
It's different for some, not for others. Certainly, the social integration is moving apace. The whites-only suburbs are now integrating quite rapidly. The segregated schools are integrating. And remember that integration in South Africa means much more than it does in the United States. We're not talking about the integration of a minority black community, but of a community that constitutes 77.4% of the total population. So when a school really does integrate, the whites rapidly become the minority. That is happening, and that is happening pretty painlessly. It's really quite astonishing how easily the white South Africans are accepting this kind of change, the social integration. Economic integration is really taking place only at the top. There is an emerging new black middle class, and that is the class that is moving into white suburbia, previously white suburbia. But I think for the vast black underclass, and South Africa has got a lot of very poor people. It's a country sitting with something like 46% unemployment. For those people stuck in their black ghettos, nothing has changed, except there is a hope in their minds that their circumstances will improve. But in practical terms, for that vast chunk of the population, nothing has changed. Let me say, too, that the comfortable way of life that white South Africans are accustomed to has also not declined at all. There is an increase in crime, and that upsets them. But by and large, life moves ahead with integration. It moves ahead with surprising smoothness. And I think even the white South Africans feel a great sense of liberation. I certainly do, as a South African, a fifth-generation white South African. I feel a tremendous liberation myself. I'm no longer part of a polecat society. I'm no longer part of a community that was committing a crime against humanity. I have that burden of guilt lifted from me. I can stand up and proclaim with pride that I am a South African. Before, I had no wish to identify with the country at all. I am about I'm in London at the moment, and later this week I shall be entering the South African High Commission here. It will be the first time in my life that I've ever set foot in an embassy of my own country.
One last question. I'm wondering if your role of journalist has changed, and if your relationships have changed since the end of apartheid. You used to be the editor of the Rand Daily Mail, which was an anti-apartheid paper. And so the people who you were going to really alienate were going to be the people in the white government. Now in the government, a lot of black South Africans, a lot of your friends are in government. And I'm wondering if they sometimes aren't enthusiastic about what you've written, which is so often the case. People in government are rarely wildly enthusiastic about the journalists who cover them.
Well, I haven't run into that kind of problem yet, but it is obviously potentially there. I find my relationship with the old regime really quite interesting. They loathed me before, and now they rush to embrace, which I find sometimes a bit embarrassing.
And why do they do that?
Well, they know that I have friends in government, I suppose. I must say that access for me is now an entirely new experience. I'm 62 years old, and for the first time I have really good access to the people in government in my country. Let me say, too, that at the journalistic level, I think the part of the liberation of South Africa is that we now have a quite remarkable degree of openness. It really has become a democracy. We now have a parliament which has got 43 standing and select committees. Those are like your committees of Congress. In the past, those were all closed to reporters. Now they are open. Anybody can walk off the street into the galleries of the National Assembly, which is our Congress. It's become a people's parliament. You don't even have to be dressed in a suit and tie anymore. You can wander in your beach clothes if you wish and just take a seat in the public gallery and listen to the debates. There are regular press conferences by the secretary to the cabinet explaining what the cabinet is doing. We have an equivalent of your First Amendment guaranteeing and entrenching freedom of speech and of the press in our constitution. And we are getting a Freedom of Information Act, similar to the one which you have in the United States. Now, those are pretty rare anywhere in the world. There can't be more than half a dozen or so countries that have that. And it's certainly unique in Africa. All of these things have been done at the behest of an African government and an African revolutionary party. And I think it's a very remarkable commitment to openness. And certainly for the media, for the journalistic community, it's an exhilarating openness that we're experiencing. Of course, journalists have always got to be on their guard. We keep saying to ourselves, will it last? We haven't yet really had a confrontation. How will they handle that when it comes to really sharp, tough criticism, perhaps of the president himself? That we still have to find out. But so far, the signs are extremely encouraging.
South African journalist Alistair Sparks. His new book is called Tomorrow is Another Country. He spoke to us earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At age 17, writer Evelyn Lau's book, Runaway, Diary of a Street Kid, became a bestseller in Canada. It told of her 2 years as a drug-addicted teenage prostitute in Vancouver. Coming up, we'll talk with Lau Her collection of short stories, Fresh Girls, has just been published in the United States. A review in the Toronto Star said about Fresh Girls, Lau wraps her raw sexual scenes in a rich poetic context. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Michael Chabon's latest novel. His first, written as his master's thesis, became a 1988 bestseller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations has threatened the Bosnian Serbs with airstrikes if there are any more attacks on United Nations safe areas. Serbian forces have shelled four such areas in the last few days. The BBC's Malcolm Brabant reports.
For months now, the popular perception of the United Nations Protection Force in Bosnia has been one of a passive organization, impotent and unwilling to act against flagrant violations of UN resolutions. But this morning, Colin Murphy announced that from now on, things would be different. In a warning to the Bosnian government, he said the UN would not be manipulated into an unwise or premature response by provocative attacks out of so-called safe areas. The recent Muslim-led offensive near Tuzla was, he said, an example of such a provocative attack. But he also had a warning for the Bosnian Serbs, who shelled the safe area of Gorazde on Saturday in what appeared to be an attempt to test the resolve of the United Nations. Mr. Murphy insisted that this was not a hollow threat. He said this robust strategy was designed to protect the humanitarian effort in Bosnia and to encourage the peace process.
Malcolm Brabant reporting. The Speaker of Iraq's parliament is suggesting that the two Americans who crossed the border into his country were intent on sabotage. He says Baghdad objects to the United States sending any spies into its country. Both men have been sentenced to 8 years in jail. The United States says both men lost their way and strayed accidentally into Iraqi territory. A White House spokesman says the Clinton administration is using quiet diplomacy to win the men's freedom. At least two presidential candidates have suggested the United States look at military options to free the men. The White House has rejected this. Attorney General Janet Reno has worked on a new initiative that she says reduces tension between federal and local police. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Addressing a modern version of the problem of the farmer and the rancher can't be friends, Reno's gotten U.S. attorneys and local authorities cooperate in task forces where the quest for credit and turf protection is minimized. She says it's working from New York and L.A. to Fort Dodge, Iowa, population 30,000.
Operation Tiger's Eye resulted in the arrest of 43 members of a violent drug gang. 38 have been convicted. Since their arrest, no murders have been reported in Fort Dodge for the first time in several years.
She says the Feds and Locals Cooperation Program is being expanded. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
A real estate trade group says sales of existing homes fell 5% in February. The National Association of Realtors says the increase in interest rates is to blame. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages averaged about 8.75% in February. The trade group says higher short-term interest rates have also caused a slowdown in the job market. On Wall Street, stock prices have closed at a record high for a third straight day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 18 points to end at 4,157. This is NPR. The head of Algeria's leading government-controlled newspaper has been shot and killed today by a suspected fundamentalist gunman. NPR's Suni Khaled reports.
Algerian government authorities said that Mohamed Abderrahmani, the director general of the El Mujahid newspaper, was gunned down in the capital, Algiers, as he was heading to work. The attack occurred near a militant Muslim rebel stronghold in southern Algiers. At least 34 journalists and media executives have been killed in the last 2 years, allegedly by anti-government rebels who have accused them of supporting the Algerian government. An estimated 40,000 people have been killed in Algeria's civil war since 1992. That's when Muslim militant factions began their struggle to topple Algeria's military-backed government, which canceled elections that a leading fundamentalist party was poised to win. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The National Labor Relations Board has asked a federal court to grant an injunction against baseball owners. This would force them to restore part of the sport's expired collective bargaining agreement. The papers have been filed in the U.S. District Court in New York. The U.S. and Japan have resumed trade talks. The first round is ended for the day in Tokyo. One top Japanese official warns his country will suspend the meetings immediately if the U.S. even mentions the possibility of imposing trade sanctions. The United States wants increased access to Japan's market for American cars and car parts. U.S. officials say they're focusing on increasing the number of dealerships that sell foreign models. They also want to boost parts purchases by Japanese automakers. South African President Nelson Mandela has fired his estranged wife Winnie from his cabinet. Winnie Mandela had been Deputy Minister of Arts, Culture, Science, and Technology. She had publicly criticized the Mandela government for its conservative policies and taken an unauthorized trip. She is also being investigated for fraud and corruption. The firing does not affect her standing in her political party, the African National Congress. She also remains a member of parliament. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Evelyn Lau, was an honor student and an aspiring writer when she ran away from home at the age of 14. She says that one of the things that drove her away was her mother's unrelenting pressure to be the top student in school. Lau's parents are Chinese immigrants who settled in Vancouver, where Lau grew up. When she ran away, she lived in a series of group homes and on the street. She used drugs and worked as a prostitute. Still an aspiring writer, she kept a journal, which became the basis of her memoir, Runaway. In 1989, when she was 17, the book became a bestseller in Canada, where it was later adapted into a made-for-TV movie. In 1992, after the publication of her second poetry collection, Oedipal Dreams, Lau became the youngest poet ever nominated for Canada's Governor General's Award. Now her collection of short stories, Fresh Girls, has been published in the U.S., all of the stories are about sex and unhappiness. Here's an excerpt of the story Fresh Girls, about a girl who works in a massage parlor.
To him and others, I'm still in my Lolita years, but I have a birthday coming up soon. I'll be 20, and what then? The back room is getting too small, and even the owner is tiring of the pretty girls with their daddy complexes curled up next to the desk where he balances the books and takes half their money. The girls who pull up their skirts and tuck their naked legs beneath them on the chair and fiddle with their long curly hair, pouting. So, Daddy, should I get it cut? I was thinking maybe I'd get it cut next time, all these split ends. Look, while they dangle a waterfall of gorgeous hair in front of him. Everyone wants to be pretty for Mario. He takes their money and lets them sit in the back room when they get old, 24, 25. Lets them eat chicken soup and buy condoms for the other girls and take in a few hairy, smelly regulars wearing checked pants and bad ties. Mario's wife comes in then with her freckled legs, wearing a red dress, tilting her head to one side and saying, "No, don't cut it. That'll be bad for business." And the girls lid their eyes and put on older mouths, the kind of mouths that say contempt and knowing. But they say, "Well, okay," and Mario continues to work hard over the ledgers.
In a way, I think of the stories in Fresh Girls as being anti-erotica, because these are all stories about sex, sex for hire, sex games, but it's always sex without pleasure for the woman in
exactly.
the story.
And I think that's extremely important, you know. When this book first came out, a lot of women wanted to leap upon it and see it as, oh, you know, a powerful book of erotica or of sexuality by a young female writer. And I felt, you know, I was quite horrified by that because I didn't feel that what I was writing about was in the least bit erotic. I mean, I personally associate something that's erotic with something that expresses desire and yearning and longing. And in my stories, the only sort of yearning that there is the yearning to be to escape from these scenarios that these women find themselves in. And I don't think prostitution is ever an erotic sort of relationship at all.
The other yearning is a yearning for love, which is never going to happen in these relationships.
Exactly. And, you know, I think it is sort of a mistake, a very sort of glib mistake that people make when they pick up a book that is ostensibly about sex, and they immediately think it is something that is meant to
sort
of... Yes, yeah. And these stories really have, I think, you know, have a much more dampening response. It's really about sort of the coldness that can exist in that sort of transaction and the lack of desire, even sort of even on the man's part. It is not so much desire, but it is a drive for power or out of some, you know, incredible loneliness and isolation.
Now, you ran away when you were 14.
Mm-hmm.
And you were a hooker for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us first why you ran away.
It was a lot of things. I was very unhappy at home. One of the most important things that drove me to leave was that I knew at an extremely young age, I knew when I was 6 years old that I was going to be a writer. And it wasn't, sort of one day saying, well, I'm going to be a writer, and the next day saying, well, you know, I might be an astronaut. I was very serious about this, and I became obsessed with writing and with books. And my parents were completely opposed to the idea that I was going to be a writer. And when they realized how serious I was, I was forbidden to write while I lived at home at all. And there were a lot of other tensions, and my father was unemployed, and so we struggled economically for several years, and that, you know, just added a lot more tension to the family, and I left. And being Asian, I knew that when I left, there was no way that I could go back. I wasn't just going to run away for a weekend and blow off some steam and go back home.
But what does being Asian have to do with it?
I think it was just inconceivable that I would run away. It was not, you know, it wasn't something that would be tolerated or even understood. The shame attached to leaving, to doing something, you know, so sort of public, I mean, because other people knew, cast an immense amount of shame upon the family. And I just knew if I were to do that, if I were to, you know, actually hurt my parents as much as I would by leaving, that would be it. And I wasn't, you know, I was the last sort of kid who anybody at school thought would run away. You know, I was an honor roll student and very, very quiet and pathologically shy. And, you know, with thick glasses and sat around writing in my notebooks all the time.
My guest is writer Evelyn Lau. Her new collection of short stories is called Fresh Girls. And she's also the author of an earlier memoir called Runaway, Diary of a Street Kid. Evelyn, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Evelyn Lau, author of a collection of short stories called Fresh Girls, and a memoir called Runaway, Diary of a Street Kid. So you ran away when you were 14.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go to?
Well, for the next 2 years, I sort of bounced around. I was everywhere. I stayed with people I just met initially, then I was sort of on the streets for a while, and I was in and out of social services, group homes and foster homes. And then, you know, I was living with people I met on the streets, and for a while I was just living on the street. And I guess when I was about, well, I guess when I turned 15, I got into prostitution. It was just one of the, it was one of the few options that were really open to me at the time. And shortly after I left home, I had a number of very bad sexual experiences very suddenly, and I had never had any before. And I was, you know, really confused. And the more things that happened to me, and it all happened in such a very short time, the less I felt that I could go back home or even tell anybody about this. I mean, again, the amount of shame was inconceivable.
You wrote about what it was like to run away and what those years were like in your memoir, Runaway. And in that book, you describe some of your early sexual encounters and how really naive you were. I mean, when you ran away, one of the things you wanted was comfort from people and comfort from men or from boys. And to get that comfort from somebody was interpreted as also wanting sex from them. So you ended up getting into sexual relationships when you were very young and not enjoying the sexual aspect of it at all.
And these were much older men, I mean, for the most part. They were men in their 40s. And, it was horrible. And very quickly, you know, I would hitchhike a lot to get around because I didn't have any money. And, men would proposition me. And it would be like for the smallest things. So sometimes I remember, I guess, you know, in a way, the first trick that I turned was somebody who paid me $10 to kiss him. And it was a man in his 50s. And I remember, you know, I still remember how awful that was, you know, sort of his big slobbering mouth and his tongue and everything. and the revulsion that I felt, and the confusion as well, that, you know, that adults were not supposed to behave this way. I'm still pretty innocent, I guess.
Well, how did you keep getting deeper into it if you found the experience revolting and humiliating?
I felt that that was all that, I suppose in a way, I felt that that was all I felt I ought to have. You know, it was a way of punishing myself for leaving, for running away, for hurting my family. It was, you know, and through drugs as well. It was just sort of this, you know, every act sort of was almost meant to erase the last one, but of course only added to it. And then after a while, I mean, there was that odd kind of misguided feeling of power that, you know, when I was like 15 and standing on a corner, I thought that, you know, like people wanted me for the first time and people praised me, you know, for something. I felt as if I could actually do something for the first time in my life and do it right, the way that I hadn't felt I could at home. I mean, looking back, it just, you know, it's, in a way, it's hard for me to understand now that I could have not known everything that I've learned since then.
Now, during the years that you had run away from home, you were living in group homes for girls, as well as sometimes living on the street, you were working as a hooker sometimes. You were also still writing, and that, mm-hmm. that writing was what your book Runaway was based
right.
on.
Right, and I was also writing poetry as well at the same time. And particularly, though, what I was really doing was I was writing a diary. And you know, in notebooks, in paper towels, and anything I could sort of, you know, stuff into my backpack, I just wrote compulsively. And it actually, at the end of 2 years, I had about 900 pages of diary entries. And it was the one thing that kept me, you know, again, feeling like I had, like I was worth more than just, you know, than just being a kid on the street.
I think you even won a couple of writing awards while mm-hmm. you were living on the street.
Oh, I know. See, I was like absolutely obsessed with becoming a writer. Even then, even through like the haze of drugs and through sort of these demeaning things that I was doing. I entered sort of poetry contests and writing, as I had always done, you know, before I had left home. And in fact, you know, this was one of the sources of conflict for me while living at home, was that, you know, I was winning these awards as, you know, as a young writer. What was hard for me when Runaway came out was that, you know, it had a lot of attention, but it was not the sort of attention given to the first book of a young writer. It was the attention given to somebody who had a sensational story to tell. And I was kind of heartbroken about that because I knew this was only going to be the first of many books, and that, you know, and in fact, shortly thereafter, I published a book of poetry and then, you know, later on, two more books of poetry before the book of stories. And, you know, and for me, it was the beginning of something, whereas a lot of people just saw it as sort of this one shot, you know, kind of book that was a curiosity, but not written by somebody who was going to keep writing.
Well, I was thinking you must have been one of the most overachieving street kids of the time.
Well, I'm still like this incredibly over. It's funny because I guess you internalize your parents, you know, and I'm still, you know, I drive myself incredibly hard with my work, and probably, you know, I would probably be a neurosurgeon or something by now if, you know, if I had gone their route. But I think, yes, I mean, I've always, even when I felt so self-destructive and I was trying to kill myself, so it was always my writing that was of the most. It was like I thought, you know, if I could only just kind of kill myself and then keep the part of me that wrote alive, then that would be ideal. And in many ways, my whole life has been struggling with that.
How did you get out of prostitution?
Well, you know, when I started feeling better about myself, it sounds really hokey, but, you know, when my work started getting some of that acclaim, you know, after my second book of poetry, and then with Fresh Girls, and I was, you know, clearly, for the first time, finally being treated seriously as a writer and as a poet. And I think that, you know, that changed a lot for me. It probably, you know, maybe it doesn't quite make sense, but to me, I mean, you have to understand that it was what I had wanted my whole life, was to be you know, taken seriously as a writer. And when that finally started happening and, you know, I started being able to make a bit of a living from my writing, you know, the prostitution no longer became necessary. And I also, you know, as I, again, you know, developed friendships and relationships that were outside of that, and when I realized that the world was so much bigger than this one very narrow, claustrophobic part of the world that I had seen or that I'd lived in for, you know, for so long.
Sexuality must seem still like such a mysterious subject, a mysterious world.
It is, kind of. And I think, you know, the writing that I most enjoy is by, in fact, like some writers I noticed that you've interviewed, like John Updike, who is able to write about sexuality from a completely different point of view and from a completely different background. And I actually, you know, I very much enjoy work like that because to me it opens up an entirely different world. Whereas a lot of sort of, I guess, middle class people look at my work as being, you know, sort of very exotic. And I sort of from the outside looking in see their lives as being equally exotic and tantalizing. I mean, it's, you know, it makes me sort of sad that I can only see it, you know, for now in a certain way.
Do you yearn for a nuclear family? You know, husband, kids?
Oh, mm-hmm. No, I don't. I don't yearn for children at all. My work is more than enough to keep me occupied. I do, however, I think, want to be married at some point. And in a funny kind of way, you know, I'm very self-sufficient and I like being by myself a lot. I have an enormous capacity for solitude. But I think, you know, I would like to know that I could have that sort of relationship with somebody despite my background, you know, because for now it feels like something that is, that I am kind of barred from in a way.
Evelyn Lau, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Evelyn Lau's collection of short stories, Fresh Girls, has just been published in the U.S. Her memoir, Runaway, will be published here in the fall. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we're going to be hearing more about the two Americans who have been imprisoned and sentenced to several years in Iraq for straying across the border, and arguments among Americans over what course to pursue. The White House insists on quiet diplomacy. Some Republican presidential aspirants say that the U.S. should take a more confrontational position and threaten the Iraqis with severe consequences if the two men aren't released. Also on today's program, we'll hear about MCI Communications, a great expansion of its online shopping services and how they work. And we'll be hearing from Silvia Poggioli about Islam in Europe.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With the publication of his first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, in 1988, writer Michael Chabon achieved a young novelist's impossible dream. He turned his creative writing master's thesis into a bestseller. In his new novel, Wonder Boys, Chabon tells a more common and bleakly comic tale about writers' lives. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I think Michael Chabon must be flirting with a literary death wish. His very first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, was an extraordinary critical success. So what does Chabon do for a second act? He cooks up an idea about a bunch of failed Pittsburgh writers who spend a lot of time drinking, smoking dope, and feeling sorry for themselves. As a plot outline, I'd say it ranks just below that show about nothing that George and Jerry pitched last season on Seinfeld. But Chabon's near-suicidal literary stunt pays off, because unlike the tormented characters he describes with such tenderness and wit, he can really write. And he proves it by taking this damp tissue of a subject and spinning it out into a story as buoyant and beautiful as silk. The biggest loser of the book is Grady Tripp, an overweight professor of creative writing whose third marriage has just collapsed. Grady's old friend and editor, Terry Crabtree, is about to be fired by the new German owners of his publishing firm. Terry explains that he doesn't fit the new corporate image. When Grady asks what that is, Terry replies, competence. Rounding out this gallery of lost souls is Grady's worst student, James Lear, who writes stories about Catholicism gone wrong and boasts a disturbing encyclopedic knowledge of Hollywood suicides. Grady refers to himself and these and other Hemingway wannabes as Wonder Boys, which is also the title of his unfinished, lousy 2,600-page novel. There are no Wonder Girls in Chabon's book, but that's okay. This is one club no woman would fight to join. The special occasion that draws Grady, Terry, and James together is a boozy writing conference, optimistically called WordFest Weekend. The weekend schedule becomes more manic when Grady's mistress announces she's pregnant, and Terry Crabtree falls in love with young James. For one entire giddy night, the three men ride around in Grady's car and inadvertently commit crimes. Hour by hour, Grady's trunk fills with stolen goods. A tuba, the satin jacket Marilyn Monroe wore when she married Joe DiMaggio, and the corpses of a dog and a boa constrictor. But Wonder Boys is much more effortlessly charming in those long stretches where Chabon slows the narrative pace down to a crawl and simply has Grady commenting on the people and scenes around him. Here's Grady describing a downtown storefront. It was one of an ever-dwindling number of classic Pittsburgh establishments, half buried in dust and an enigmatic European gloom, that deal in rendering vats, pierogi presses, artificial wigs, and that regardless of the hour or day of the week, always look as if they have been closed since the death of Guy Lombardo. Because Grady thinks such funny and forlorn thoughts, you feel the great pity of his writing block, that he somehow can't translate his observations onto paper like his creator, Chabon, can. This novel about would-be and has-been writers at first sounds like an excuse for Chabon to indulge in self-congratulatory navel-gazing. But Wonder Boys is really a generous comic lament for all those artistic dreamers out there who hopelessly love what they'll never possess.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Wonder Boys by Michael Chabon. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Kathy Wolf and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the reshaping of America's defense system. We talk with Michael Clare, author of the new book Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, America's Search for a New Foreign Policy. Clare says if the U.S. overprepares for a third world conflict, it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.